Yesterday, we were talking about some events that happened, I believe, right around the 14th year of David, which also happened to be a sabbatical year. The events that we will eventually get to today are going to take place about 6 years after that, in the 20th year of David, or if we want to talk about specific years, I think 998 going into 997 BC. Now, I'm more confident about the placement of these events because they are backdated from the birth of Solomon. And we know about the transition phase from David's kingdom to Solomon's kingdom. The events that we will start talking about today are going to lead us into the bad years of King David. And we are going to have to be perfectly honest with these bad years as we move forward. We know and love David as a man after God's own heart, but we are also aware that he made some poor choices that impacted upon him and his family and his kingdom. And that is something that needs to be learned from, to avoid doing the same sort of sinful things. Now, since the events that kick off these chain of poor choices involves fighting military battles, I thought now might be the time for us to quickly go through the lists of David's mighty men. The list that we're going to particularly pay attention to is found in 1 Chronicles chapter 11, starting at verse number 10, and that's where I'd like you to go right now. 1 Chronicles chapter 11, verse 10. There is a parallel to it in 2 Samuel 23, starting at verse 8, which we will also have to look into from time to time, because there are slight variations between these two parallel accounts. Some of it is accounted for just because of scribal difficulties. I've told you before, hand copying things accurately is difficult, particularly in spelling of proper names and also in the spelling of numbers, because they would have spelled out their numbers. And those are where the variations typically occur. It doesn't impact upon the inspiration of the scripture, because we know that the original documents, we have faith that the original documents were motivated in their production by the Holy Spirit. But some spelling variations have come in over the years because of scribal problems, and we should just certainly be aware of those and take note. Often, English Bibles will have footnotes that highlight these variations. Okay, so let's go to 1 Chronicles chapter number 11, verse 10. Now, these are the chiefs of David's mighty men who gave him strong support in his kingdom together with all Israel to make him king according to the word of he who is concerning Israel. So the heading basically says, here are the guys that help David come to the throne and to maintain his kingdom. We know that Joab, who is mentioned in the section immediately before this, received the leadership over the entirety of the Israeli army because he took Jerusalem intact. David had made a vow, whoever does that is going to be the leader of the Israeli army. So he's the top general, we would say. The first three men that we see listed here are the men that come immediately under Joab. They are the top commanders. And this section tells us their actions of heroic effort that put them into those positions of leadership. So let's look at their names. Verse number 11 says, this is an account of David's mighty men. Yashobeam, a Hachmonite was chief of the three. Now you'll see a slight difference in his spelling of his name and where he's from, but it still shows him to be the number one guy of the top three. And so this is the reason why. He wielded his spear against 300 whom he killed at one time. So in one battle, he used his spear to take out 300 of the enemy. Now the 2 Samuel 23 passage says it was 800. Either number, that's a lot of people on the other side to take out in one battle. So that's why he's the number one of the top three commanders. Verse 12, next to him, or number two on the list, among the three mighty men was Eleazar, the son of Dodo, the Ahohite. He was with David at Pas Damim when the Philistines were gathered there for battle. There was a plot of ground full of barley, and the men fled from the Philistines. So we've talked about this idea that the Philistines invaded the border territory of Judah in particular, but also Benjamin and the areas of Dan during times of harvest, because they wanted all of the hard work of the Israelis to now become theirs. And so the Israeli army spent a lot of their time responding to such incursions. Now, on this particular occasion, they are down near the Valley of Elah and defending a barley field from the Philistine invasion. And apparently, the Israelis get overrun, and a lot of them run away, retreat from the fight. But not David and not Eleazar. Verse 14, he took his stand in the middle of the plot and defended it and killed the Philistines, and he who is saved them by a great victory. The 2 Samuel 23:10 passage has a little bit more detail on that. It says, he rose and struck down the Philistines until his hand was weary and his hand clung to the sword. And he who is brought about a great victory that day, and the men returned after him only to strip the slain. So I can kind of picture in my mind, here is Eleazar and David standing back to back, fighting Philistines coming from all directions, and they're just killing them right and left. And when the fight is over, Eleazar's hand has seized up so tight on the hilt of his sword that it pretty much has to be peeled off. And this is something that happens when you hold on to something really, really tight. Your joints kind of lock in place because of muscle tightness. And it must have been quite the fight for this to have happened to Eleazar. But that is why he is number two of the top three commanders under Joab inside the United Israeli Army. Now, the next guy is not in the list of 1 Chronicles 11, for whatever reason. But he is in the 2 Samuel 23, verse 11 list. And this is what it says. Next to him, so number three of the top three, was Shammah, the son of Agi, the Hararite. The Philistines gathered together at Lehi, where there was a plot of ground full of lentils, and the men fled from the Philistines. So same sort of story again. There is a harvest, this time it's of lentils, and the Israelis are there trying to defend it from the Philistines' incursion, and they get overrun, everybody runs away except for Shammah. And what does he do? Verse 12, he took his stand in the midst of the plot of ground and defended it and struck down the Philistines, and he who is worked a great victory. So these three guys all came to their positions of leadership at the top tier because they don't back down. They stay with the fight. They let God work through them. The next thing that we read in both passages is that these were the three guys that, overhearing David say, "Oh, I wished I could have a drink of the water from the well at Bethlehem," at the time when the Philistines had invaded and surrounded the city of Bethlehem. They took off on their own, fought their way in, got a canteen full of water from the Bethlehem well, and brought it back to David. You remember that story? And David poured the water out as a drink offering to He Who Is. And that would not have been an insult to these men. It would have been a compliment to them that David was not worthy of drinking this water. Only God should have this water because these guys put their blood on the line in order to get it. So those are the top three guys and why they're in those positions of leadership. Back to 1 Chronicles chapter 11, this time verse number 20. Now, Abishai, the brother of Joab, was chief of the 30. So everybody's kind of arranged in groups of three, it sounds like. You've got Joab, who's the commander of the entire army. You've got the top three tier guys that we just listed. And then we've got 30 sub-commanders underneath them. So maybe 10 of these sub-commanders underneath each of the three top three. And here is Abishai, who is listed as being the most significant among those 30 top-tier sub-commanders. The reason why is he wielded his spear against 300 men and killed them and won a name beside the three. He was the most renowned of the 30 and became their commander, but he did not attain to the three. So he's as good as the 30, the best of the 30, but he's not quite up there with the top three guys. Another man. And this guy we've met before on a list because he ends up being David's pick for his bodyguard and for his courier corps. It says, Benaiah, the son of Jehoiada, was a valiant man of Kabzeel, a doer of great deeds. He struck down two heroes of Moab. So two big fighters from Moab whenever they were having a fight with them. But he also went down and struck down a lion in a pit on a day when snow had fallen. Now, they did have lions in Israel at this time. And for whatever reason, Benaiah decided to go down and take one on in a pit on a snowy day. So it's winter time. And he ends up killing it. And so that's an example of his bravery. Still more, verse 23. He struck down an Egyptian, a man of great stature, 5 cubits tall. So that's about 7.5 feet tall. The Egyptian had in his hand a spear like a weaver's beam. That means it's kind of round, like a closet rod. Where it kind of matches how tall he is. But Benaiah went down to him with a staff and snatched the spear out of the Egyptian's hand and killed him with his own spear. So he takes him on in single combat and takes his spear and kills him. That's the ultimate insult, to kill your opponent with their own weapon because they couldn't stop you from taking it. Verse 24, these things did Benaiah, the son of Jehoiada, and won a name beside the three mighty men. He was renowned among the 30, but he did not attain to the three, and David set him over his bodyguard and also over his courier corps. Now, the rest of the list, just goes through all of those who have served at one time or another in the 30. And it is a rotating list. And we can tell that because the first guy on the list here, verse 26, is dead fairly early on in David's kingdom. The mighty men were Asahel, the brother of Joab. So Asahel was killed at the beginning of the civil war between David and Ish-Baal, the remaining son of King Saul. And that happened in the first year of David's kingdom. There are more than 30 names on this list. In fact, I've kind of reduced this to a list form in my Chronological Companion, which you can find on the website if you're curious about some of the notes that I use. There are, as far as I can tell, 50 names between these two passages that are on the 30. And so Asahel is an example of one of the ones that died and then was replaced by somebody else. Number 34 on my list is Uriah the Hittite, who will be important to a story later. So he must have come onto the list fairly early in the kingdom of David. And he is a non-Israeli, but apparently a convert to the Israeli faith. Well, I think we can now go, because I don't want to read all these names, I think we can now go to the historical situation that brings about the bad years of King David. I invite you to open to 2 Samuel chapter 10 now. The parallel is found in 1 Chronicles 19. So we're going to follow the wording of 2 Samuel for the most part. So it says here, after this, now that's a reference back to where David sought out and brought into his palace the grandson of King Saul, the son of Jonathan, Merib-Baal, and treats him as a member of the family. So we're a few years past that when this event happens. So after this, the king of the Ammonites died, and Hanun, his son, reigned in his place. Now the name of this king is given over in the First Chronicles passage. It's mentioned in the next verse here. His name is Nahash. We know that King Saul fought against a Nahash, king of the Ammonites, very early in his own kingdom. And if I'm correct in my chronology, that's been 40 years ago. Josephus believed, and I also kind of lean toward this understanding, that King Saul killed that Nahash. So this Nahash is likely to be the son of that original one, who has now grown older and has passed away, either from some sort of old age or health concerns, or he's been involved in a fight somewhere. But the strange thing is that David has had good relationships with Nahash. Now, a lot of the commentators go with the idea that this Nahash is the original Nahash, and I suppose that's possible, that David eventually developed a relationship with that original Nahash, and there were understandings about the boundaries between eastern Israel and the kingdom of the Ammonites. But again, I believe it's likely to have been a second Nahash who made the relationships with David and kept those boundaries properly maintained. Regardless, what we see here is David being sorry that someone on his eastern border in leadership has passed away. and that someone new, his son, has come to the throne. And so verse 2, David said, I will deal loyally, or kindly is the literal meaning of the word, with Hanun, the son of Nahash, as his father dealt loyally with me, or kindly with me. So David feels like he needs to send a contingent of condolence to the new king of the Ammonites to basically say, I'm sorry for the loss of your father, and I would like for us to have good relationships going forward. So the rest of the text says, so David sent by his servants to console him concerning his father, and David's servants came into the land of the Ammonites. Now, eastern Israel is not horribly wide. It's on the east side of the Jordan Valley. So it has the Jordan Valley area, the Jordan River Valley area, plus the highlands immediately east of there. So that's eastern Israel. The Ammonite territory begins, I think it's like less than 20 miles to the east of the Jordan Valley. So they're going to head over there and cross from Israeli territory immediately into Ammonite territory and pay their respects, pay David's respects. But it doesn't get to happen that way because of this. Verse 3, but the princes of the Ammonites, so men in leadership who had served under the original Nahash, they feel like David should not be trusted. And they communicate that to the new king. They said to Hanun, their lord, do you think because David has sent comforters to you that he is honoring your father? Has not David sent his servants to you to search the city, to spy it out, and to overthrow it? So they put the bug in his ear. They stir the pot that David is only looking to expand his kingdom eastward now that your father is dead. David sees this as a weak opportunity for him. You're weak, and he can take it over. And the only reason these guys are here is so they can kind of check out our defenses, kind of check out how much military might we have, and then David is going to try to take us over. So we can't allow him to get away with this covert operation. And they convince Hanun to treat David's representatives as if they are spies, as if they are trying to pull a fast one. So verse 4, Hanun took David's servants and shaved off half the beard of each and cut off their garments in the middle at their hips and sent them away. Now it's clear that he was trying to insult them, but it's possible that he may have used their words of condolence as the reason for doing what he did. Some people think that they just cut off maybe the right-hand side or the left-hand side of the beard. I'm of the opinion that what happened was they shaved the top half of their beards on both sides of their heads. You may remember back in the Mosaic Law that the Israelis were told, do not shave the corners of your beard. Do not cut the corners of your beard. The reason they were told that is because some of the pagan peoples of the Middle East did that as part of their grief ceremonies in relationship to their gods and their goddesses. And so I think it may be that Hanun and his advisors said to the Israelis, so you've come here to grieve? Well, why don't you join us in our grief? And got them down and shaved off the sides of their head, shaved off the sides of their beard, which would have been a direct violation of Israeli law. So they have been greatly shamed by that. Another thing that was very widespread amongst the peoples of the Middle East in their grief ceremonies was the ripping of your clothing. And it became so prominent that sometimes people would put on special clothing whenever they got ready to do this so that they could rip the special clothing. I think it's possible that the cutting off of part of the Israeli clothing may have been a mockery of that process, effectively saying, so, you want to show your grief? Let's see your clothing torn up. But the way that they cut their clothing off was to cut them off at the, apparently, the backside of the hips, so that, well, there's no better way to put this than their bottoms basically started hanging out the backside of their clothing. I mean, they would probably have what would pass for underwear on, but this was still very shameful. And then they sent them away. Verse number 5. When it was told David, he sent to meet them, for the men were greatly ashamed. And the king said, remain at Jericho until your beards have grown and then return. So they come back down the Jordan Valley to Jericho. The story is passed up the chain to David, and David understands that they are reasonably ashamed. They can replace their clothes, but they can't immediately replace their beards. So David tells them, you just hang out in a private place down there in Jericho before coming home, because I know you don't want to be seen this way. So verse 6 says, when the Ammonites saw that they'd become a stench to David, they did some things we'll talk about starting tomorrow. But we now see that the Ammonites are expecting David to retaliate for this horrible insult to him and his kingdom.